This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. We're following the breaking story out of Pakistan this morning. Former Pakistani Prime Minister and opposition leader Benazir Bhutto has been assassinated. Reports from the Associated Press and other media organizations indicate that Bhutto was killed during a rally in Rawalpindi that had been targeted by a suicide bombing. She was apparently shot by a gunman as she got into her car to leave the rally. The shot struck her in the neck and chest. The gunman then blew himself up. Bhutto was pronounced dead at 6:16 p.m. at a local hospital. Benazir Bhutto had just recently returned to Pakistan, and you may recall that her homecoming in October was marked by a suicide bombing that killed more than 100 people. The rally she was attending today was the first rally since the violence on the day of her homecoming, and security around Bhutto had been very tight. She'd expressed concerns about her personal safety in media interviews. CNN is showing video this morning of Bhutto getting into a well-guarded SUV on her way to the rally. Again, reports are indicating that she was in the car when she was shot and killed. Political analysts in Pakistan are describing the death of Bhutto today as a political earthquake. The Associated Press reports that her supporters surrounded the hospital to which Bhutto was taken and began chanting anti-Musharraf epithets. Others wept and smashed the main door of the hospital. Pervez Musharraf had called parliamentary elections for January 8th, and Bhutto had recently polled ahead of other opposition candidates. The United States has condemned the attack on Benazir Bhutto, saying it shows that there are still those in Pakistan trying to undermine reconciliation and democratic development in Pakistan. A top Russian diplomat in Moscow was quoted this morning saying he feared that Bhutto's assassination could trigger a wave of terror. We're going to turn now to several guests for some insight and context into what this means for the country. Shumit Ganguly is professor of political science, director of research at the Center for American and Global Security at Indiana University. And he's with us this morning from Bloomington, Indiana. Professor, good to have you on the show. Thanks very much for being with us on short notice.
Good morning. I'm happy to be on the show despite the tragic circumstances.
We appreciate you joining us. Fazi Zaka is a radio and television host in Pakistan, where he also writes columns for several English language newspapers. He joins us by phone from Islamabad, Pakistan. Fazi, thank you very much for being with us on short notice. I know you've got a lot of news to cover there, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
A bit later in the hour, Rick Barton is going to be with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And throughout our conversation, we'll be updating the news as we get it from Pakistan, and we'll bring that to you as quickly as possible. Fazi, you're in Islamabad. That's, what, a short distance away from this rally where Benazir Bhutto was killed. We're still getting some conflicting details about what happened. What do you know as of right now?
As of now, there are very few things that are actually confirmed. One is that
I should say that Fazi Zaka is joining us from Pakistan. The lines are probably in and out, and we have been trying to reach him on his cell phone, so we'll try to reconnect with him. Fazi, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. I think your line dropped out a second ago. You were saying that there are conflicting reports. What do you know right now? All right, I think we're going to try to call him back so that we can clear the line there. Professor Ganguly, when we got in touch with you this morning, I don't think you had heard the news yet. Your initial reaction when you heard this, I mean, is it all that unexpected given the violence around Pakistan and around the homecoming of Benazir Bhutto?
It's not all that unexpected, even though this is a truly tragic occurrence, because it now throws the entire election into disarray, and it raises serious questions about the future stability of the Pakistani state, stability which was already at considerable question.
Benazir Bhutto had feared for her life. She had actually said in recent media interviews that she had been receiving threats. What's your knowledge about how security had been increased around her and whether this is something that the family had kind of accepted might be a real possibility?
I think this is a possibility that any politician in Pakistan has to seriously entertain, given the level of violence that has pervaded the country over the last several years. Suicide attacks are hardly unknown in Pakistan, and they have grown in frequency in the recent past. because of the plethora of jihadist groups operating within Pakistan. While one can dramatically increase the level of security, there is no body of security that can guarantee one's safety in a situation as fraught as Pakistan.
We should remind our listeners that there have been 9 failed assassination attempts on President Musharraf's life. Fazi Zaka, are we back with you?
Yes.
All right, good. We know, again, that you're calling us from Islamabad, and the lines may be up and down, so we'll just deal with that. You were starting to tell us that there are some conflicting details about what happened to Benazir Bhutto. What are you hearing this morning?
Well, what's happened for sure, that they've established that she was shot first, both in the neck and in the head, and subsequently the person who was doing the shooting blew himself up. And in the hospital, eventually she had lost consciousness and that she couldn't breathe on her own. She might have been on a respirator and then during some kind of operation to revive her, she actually died.
Fazi,
so at this point, this is what we know.
Is it true, Fazi, that she had already spoken to supporters at this rally and she was getting into her car to leave the rally when she was attacked?
Yes.
And the gunman was able to get, apparently, inside her security perimeter.
Well, this I cannot confirm, but from what has been said so far is that the rally itself was very well secured and that the security detail worked there to some degree, but it said when she was leaving, that's where the lapse in security happened, apparently.
Has President Musharraf made an official statement yet?
Yes. He has condoled the death and has stated that he grieves her loss. And the same is true of the caretaker prime minister in Pakistan.
Professor Ganguly, who may be blamed for this? And may President Musharraf be one of the people blamed for the death of Benazir Bhutto?
Her supporters invariably will blame General Musharraf, suggesting that he did not provide adequate security and, in addition to that, created conducive conditions for the return of elements of the Taliban to Pakistan. And that's, frankly, to be expected from her supporters in their moment of grief. Legitimately, one might blame at this point, even in the absence of clear-cut evidence, but on the basis of inference and attribution, most likely this is the work of various jihadist groups or any one of various jihadist groups in Pakistan who were unalterably opposed to her return and to the possibility of her entering political life once again in the wake of parliamentary elections, which were originally scheduled for January 8th.
Fazi Zaka, we're already seeing reports here, I'll bet you're hearing this as well, that her tightest circle, Benazir Bhutto's tightest circle, is saying, we had told the government we needed more security, we were asking for it, they wouldn't listen to us. Are you hearing that as well?
Well, I'd just like to add 2 things to that.
Yes.
That Benazir has often spoken about the fact that her life was under threat, but by and large, most people did not believe that to be true. For example, when she came back to Pakistan on October 18th, she had an 18-hour rally from the airport to the final destination of the rally. And when the bomb blew up, killing 140 people, where she escaped, unhurt, and she managed to get away, there was wide circulation of the fact that it took her 18 hours to get from one place to another, but only 18 minutes to get away. And the idea of that slur or that assertion was to sort of damage her credibility that her life was under attack in any sense, or that she even had a slight role in perpetrating an attack on herself to make it look as if she was, under threat. But for the longest time, nobody has actually given serious thought to the fact that her life was actually under such grave danger. And today, when it finally happened, by and large, everyone is shell-shocked because they cannot actually digest the fact that somebody would take on an institution such as she was. And just one more thing also about the fact that people might be blaming Musharraf, but there's also a very real sense that people are blaming Musharraf's party that he created, which was the Pakistan Muslim League Q Group, which was the previous government. And right now in Pakistan, some offices of the PMLQ have been attacked, which I must add is different from Nawaz Sharif's faction, which is the PMLN. And the reason for that is before this attack took place that took her life, there was a rally where Nawaz Sharif was also present in Rawalpindi, and his supporters were fired upon by what most people claim were PMLQ people.
If you're listening in this morning on Mid-Morning, we're following up, giving you some context and analysis, of course, on the news coming out of Pakistan this morning, the startling news that Benazir Bhutto, former prime minister and opposition party leader, has been assassinated. She was apparently shot after speaking to supporters at a large rally in Rawalpindi. The news reports that we're getting, and our guests are assuring us that there are still conflicting reports coming in about this, but details seem to indicate that she had spoken to the crowd of supporters. She was leaving the rally. She was in a vehicle. She was surrounded by some security guards. A gunman managed to shoot her. She was taken to a local hospital where she died at 6:16 p.m. Pakistan time. We've asked several guests to be with us this hour to give us some analysis, their thoughts about what this means for the country, what it means for the January 8th parliamentary elections, what it means for the increasing instability that we're seeing in Pakistan. One of our guests, Fazi Zaka, is with us from Islamabad, Pakistan, where he's a radio and television host. He writes columns for several English language newspapers. Shumit Ganguly is with us as well, professor of political science and director of research at the Center for American and Global Security at Indiana University. A bit later, Rick Barton from the Center for Strategic and International Studies is going to be with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have questions about this, the alliance between Pakistan and the United States, what's it going to mean for that? We'll talk about that as well. 1-800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. Online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Click on Send a Question. 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Click on Send a Question. Just to let you know that as we have our discussion this morning with our guests, we're keeping a close eye on the news that's coming out of Pakistan, and we'll be bringing you that as soon as we get it. Professor Ganguly, what do you think this means for the January 8th parliamentary elections? Do you think they will still go forward as planned?
I think it's too early to predict if they'll go ahead as planned. I think much depends on what transpires in the next 48 hours. It remains to be seen what kinds of demonstrations ensue in Pakistan's major cities and how the military responds to this. I think, personally, I think it would be inadvisable to go ahead with the elections, given the state of uncertainty that surrounds Pakistan, because I don't know how the campaigning can go on in this kind of vitiated atmosphere, and given the extreme security concerns that obviously stalk the land. So I think it would be wise to postpone the elections, even though I am all in favor of the most prompt return to democratic institutions in Pakistan. But holding meaningful elections under the present circumstances, I think, is exceedingly difficult.
Fazi Zaka, is that the assumption, although I understand that Musharraf has not made an official statement on this, that the parliamentary elections may be delayed past January 8th?
Well, it's too early to say, but what's happening is most people did predict that there would be a conflagration of violence across the country, and that is already happening. We find that Karachi is in the midst of some small degree of chaos. Hyderabad is in severe distress because of people taking to the streets. The major issue right now is that her funeral remains, and in Pakistan, in Muslim societies, funerals happen pretty much within 24 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And mourning is not a private emotion as you find in the West. It's a very public thing in Pakistan, where that grief is shown as an affirmation of somebody's life. And you'd find that emotions will run very high once the funeral procession takes place. There will be retribution. There are, you know, caterers of party workers who might...
I think we have lost Fazi Zaka's line there. He is with us this morning from Islamabad, Pakistan. We'll try to reconnect. I think he was saying that Benazir Bhutto's funeral will be held, he believes, within the next 24 to 48 hours, and there is great concern about the demonstrations that may occur, potential violence, retribution around Benazir Bhutto's funeral. 1-800-242-2828 to join our conversation this morning about the news out of Pakistan, the assassination of opposition leader Benazir Bhutto. 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, reach us at minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question to Linda in Hopkins. Good morning, Linda. Your question for us.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Carrie.
Sure.
I'm hoping you can just give us some brief context of why she left Pakistan in the first place and what the significance of her coming back was.
Professor, I'll
take my answer off call.
Yeah, thanks very much for the question. Professor Ganguly, why she left, why she came back?
She had left because there were a spate of corruption charges against her, and she would have been prosecuted had she stayed on in Pakistan by the military regime. She came back under a deal with the military regime because General Musharraf passed an ordinance which basically put all these things in abeyance, and thereby, with this kind of protection, she chose to come back.
I think we have Fazi Zaka back on the line. Fazi, you with us again?
Yes.
All right. Again, to explain to our listeners here, we're reaching you in Islamabad, Pakistan, and the lines are a bit uncertain. I don't want to pass over something that you were saying before we lost you, which is that her funeral will be held, I think you were saying, between the next 24 to 48 hours, and there's great concern about what will happen around the funeral procession. Why?
Well, that's because, one, you'll find that most of her workers will be in an extremely emotional state. And again, when it comes to mourning in Pakistan, it's a very public emotion. People show emotion just to affirm somebody's life who's just passed away. And with that, I mean, it's going to be essentially reliving her assassination within just a day or two, as opposed to having a breather of a week or two for people to sort of take stock and hold of the situation. And on top of that, that's another time when recriminations might increase. We've also got a very real danger when it comes to the elections that if things get out of hand, another state of emergency will be held in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is a state of emergency under that, then you do not have elections. So that's another problem. And our state of emergency, which was imposed for 6 weeks, just ended about a month ago. So there is a slight chance that we have significant problems when it comes to polling in January.
Yeah, just to let our listeners know here, Neil Conan is going to host an NPR news special on Benazir Bhutto's legacy as Prime Minister of Pakistan. You can listen in for that at 1 o'clock today. Fazi, an online question here from JP in Woodbury. I associate her as the leader of the pro-democracy movement. Is that a fair characterization?
It is. It is a fair characterization, but the pro-democracy movement in Pakistan is no longer a monolith like it used to be. Ironically, most of the Islamist right-wing parties are also now in the mood to go for a Western-style democracy. They've actually decided not to participate in our elections in January, largely because the judiciary remains unfree and it remains under artificial restrictions because certain judges were removed. But with Benazir, she had a aura about her which did identify her very closely to democracy, except for the recent 6 months where she took a battering at the hands of the press. She took a battering where many of her supporters were even disillusioned by her willingness to deal with the military government and Musharraf. And on top of that, her complicitness in a law which we call the National Reconciliation Ordinance, which essentially took away every case in which there were even convictions and in which there were even cases abroad which the government had to withdraw from, and especially in Switzerland, where there was going to be a conviction if the government had not withdrawn their case.
Hmm.
So in that context, while she stood for democracy, her wheeling and dealing, so to speak, to get back into the electoral fray in Pakistan post-October 18 had disillusioned a lot of her supporters.
Let me take
a note. Her legacy, while remains one that is strong, it's always been mired by allegations of corruption, especially that by her husband. But in the past couple of months, her willingness to deal with anti-democratic forces had posed a significant challenge to her image as a Democrat.
And let me take another call here about her legacy to David in Grand Rapids. Good morning, David. You're on Mid Morning.
Good morning.
Hi, your question.
My question is sort of once removed from this, the initial sort of look at this as an internal Pakistani event that, you know, maybe one side faction killed her for the upcoming elections. However, what do your guests think is the U.S. role in all this, given that a lot of people in America just saw the movie Charlie Wilson's War, where they talk about Ziaul-Haq having hung Benazir's dad.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have a military guy backed by the U.S. getting rid of the last Bhutto, and now we have another military guy in Pakistan that the U.S. supports, and another Bhutto is gone.
Professor Ganguly, what do you make of that?
Well, there is little question that the court that sentenced Benazir's father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, to the gallows was basically a kangaroo court. While there were serious charges that were leveled against him, the manner in which he was dispatched left a great deal to be desired. And at that time, General Ziaul-Haq was in the doghouse, but with the United States, because the Carter administration took a very dim view of the judicial proceedings. But on the other hand, all of General Zia's sins were forgiven when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan on the 24th of December 1979. And at that point, the U.S. Embraced Pakistan because it needed to prosecute, it wanted to prosecute a war against the Soviets. And then we ended up supporting General Ziaul-Haq all the way until his assassination in the summer of 1988. So there is a certain level of American complicity in terms of supporting a rather unpopular and harsh military dictator because he served our larger geopolitical interests. And we have, in a similar fashion, General Musharraf was in the doghouse with us until the 10th of September. It's really on the 11th of September 2001 that everything changed. And we came to support General Musharraf because we wanted to use him to essentially dislodge the Taliban regime in Afghanistan and prosecute a war against the Al-Qaeda. And there again, we have overlooked many shortcomings of the Musharraf regime.
Let me bring Rick Barton in. He's with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies from Washington, D.C. Rick Barton, thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
One of the reactions that has come this morning from around the world to Benazir Bhutto's assassination is concern from Russia that this will unleash what they called a wave of terrorism. Is that a real concern?
I think there are a lot of valid concerns at this moment. I suspect that there will be more tragedies and unpredictable events in Pakistan in the coming weeks because the basic situation is really not squared away. The United States doesn't have a whole lot of influence in it at this point because we are the people of Pakistan are quite alienated from us. And so it's one of these very difficult situations. It's huge. It's complex. It's not in a happy state, and it will probably mean the end of Musharraf's regime, whether it's in 10 minutes or in 10 months.
Why do you say that?
Well, because the situation is really beyond his control, and the military, which has been the institution that people have counted on to stabilize or at least to give the feeling of stability in Pakistan, is clearly not able to maintain control. And they don't really want to give up their business interests and all the other things that they've gone into. So they will probably sacrifice Musharraf as a way of putting a kinder, gentler face on the transition and maybe delay the elections as well so that they're able to suggest that they're moving towards a resolution of a crisis. But the crisis is really one of extremism, of a police and a judiciary that have been completely undermined for years, of an elite, a political elite that hasn't opened up to the people, and of an extremely young and growing country, which is restless.
Do you think this is the end of the Bhutto legacy?
No, I think in a way it will probably enhance the legacy because she she is clearly a martyr, and so the mythology will grow, and it might in fact strengthen her party. She really wasn't a politician who had been in touch with the country because of her exile, but also just when I saw her a year ago and then again this fall, she just seemed to be out of shape for the challenge ahead. And as is her party, because it's really been a party of inheritance and not particularly open, but it still is the best organized of the Democratic parties and has the broadest following, and I think that will grow as a result of this tragedy.
And that's my other question. What kind of a position, then, does her assassination put some of the other opposition leaders in whenever these elections are held, whether it's January 8th or beyond?
It really depends on how well they handle these events. The amazing thing has been how ham-handed many of the mainstream politicians have been in dealing with attacks on their counterparts in the other parties, and they have not shown solidarity. They have not been a moderate core that they could be, and they have to be at this moment, because it's when faced with extremists of all stripes, the middle has to step up, and that hasn't really been seen other than the lawyers and some of these street gatherings. So that's the challenge of the moment. And if a political leader shows the right response, there's a chance that they could also develop a following during this time.
One last question, because I know you have to run. Recently, an American news magazine put Pakistan on its cover, saying it's the most dangerous place in the world, not Iran, not North Korea. Do you agree with that?
I think it has the most potential to be an incredibly dangerous place. It's in a much bigger, more populous neighborhood. It does have nuclear weapons. It's one of the new eight nuclear powers, and it's a neighborhood where a lot of other people have nuclear weapons or aspire to. So that really does compound it. Plus, it's mere size, having 160 million people, and in huge cities such as Karachi, makes it really very difficult to govern unless you have a clear representation, a clear popular representation in the government, and that's what's needed now.
Rick Barton, I thank you for spending some time with us this morning. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Rick Barton at the Center for Strategic and International Studies with us from Washington, D.C. Shumit Ganguly continues with us, professor of political science, director of research at the Center for American and Global Security at Indiana University. Fazi Zaka is with us. Fazi, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Great. He's with us, radio and television host in Pakistan, where he also writes some columns in several English language newspapers. And he's with us by phone from Islamabad, Pakistan. We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, continue our conversations about the implications of the assassination this morning of former Prime Minister and opposition leader Benazir Bhutto. By the way, at 1 o'clock today, Neil Conan hosts an NPR news special on Bhutto's legacy as Prime Minister of Pakistan. That is 1 o'clock. It will take the place of the first hour of Talk of the Nation. You can join our conversation, 1-800-242-2828 in the metro area, 651-227-6000. Join us online, minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on to send a question. But now to the newsroom and Perry Finelli for the latest on the Bhutto assassination. Good morning, Perry.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you. Pakistani opposition leader Benazir Bhutto has been assassinated. Aides say she was shot just after she addressed thousands at a campaign rally. The gunman then blew himself up. At least 20 other people were killed in the attack, which the State Department is condemning. A spokesman says the attack shows there are still those who want to undermine efforts to advance democracy in Pakistan. There are fears in Pakistan the assassination will lead to widespread violence. Among the unanswered questions following the slayings of six people in a home near Seattle is why authorities did not do more to investigate an interrupted 911 call from from the home on Christmas Eve. Deputies arrived to find the gate locked and they left. A woman and her boyfriend are in custody. Media reports say the woman's parents are among the victims. Police are reportedly investigating whether one or more of the young men mauled by a tiger at the San Francisco Zoo had taunted the animal first. The San Francisco Chronicle says police found a shoe and some blood in an area near the edge of the animal's moat. Minnesota zoos say they are prepared in case and their animals try to escape. Officials with the Minnesota Zoo in Apple Valley and the Como Zoo in St. Paul say they are required to have extensive safety procedures, including annual safety drills and daily inspections of exhibits. For cases when tall fences and other security measures fail, the zoos have several staff members who are trained to shoot and kill escaped animals. A revered leader of the Hmong community in the U.S. has made his first public appearance in California since he was arrested for an alleged attempt to overthrow the communist government in Laos. Former Laotian General Vang Pao addressed thousands of supporters yesterday at Fresno's Hmong International New Year celebration. The 78-year-old did not address allegations he helped lead a coup attempt organized by Hmong refugees in the U.S. Vang Pao also has a home in St. Paul. Weather forecast today calls for cloudy skies, still some areas of fog in western and southern Minnesota this morning, and some areas of light snow in the northern part of the state. Highs today 15 to 25. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's 23 and the skies are cloudy. It's 9:37. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
If you could only listen to 2 hours of radio the entire year, the Third Coast Festival broadcast is the program for you. Of course, if you never turn your radio off, this is also the program for you. The Third Coast Festival chooses the best audio documentaries from all over the world in its annual competition. And we've put those winners together in a show of unforgettable radio. Tune in to hear the best of the best. You can hear the Third Coast Audio Festival on Tuesday afternoon, New Year's Day, at 1 here on Minnesota Public Radio News, including 91.1 KNOW in the Twin Cities. We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller, talking this morning about the implications of the news out of Pakistan that opposition leader and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has been assassinated. Back to our guest this morning, Fazi Zaka, joining us this morning from Islamabad, Pakistan, and Shumit Ganguly with us from Indiana University. Fazi, I'm curious about what you think about what Rick Barton said, that this spells the end of Musharraf's leadership, whether it's in 10 minutes or 10 months. Do you think that's true?
I think that I wouldn't go as far. It's a tenuous situation because the real power player in the Pakistan context is actually the army. And the current chief of army staff, after Musharraf retired, is a very close friend and is ideologically aligned to Musharraf. So if there is no elections in the forthcoming period, he will not actually resign. There is no pressure that can come from any particular avenue, unless, of course, the demonstrations get out of hand. But once, of course, parliament is elected, there's a good chance that, you know, there's a spillover effect that benefits Nawaz Sharif, who used to be what we'd call, you know, a bitter enemy in politics to Benazir Bhutto, but who had gotten together with her in their fight against Musharraf or for democracy right now. And since he's been saying all the right things, he's condemned the death, he's come out, and he's promised to lead the struggle in her name as well, he stands to benefit. And if that does happen, if that party does come to power, which is slightly more organized, because the PPP, while it is organized structurally and it has a good cadre of workers, the real problem is that there is no identified successor. And the only one might be is Benazir's husband, but he has alienated most of the party, largely because they feel that he brought the party down because he was instrumental in all the corruption that's been alleged against Benazir. And unless one of her kids can come up, but they're too young and they can't actually contest the elections, the PPP will suffer to a degree. Maybe the PML and Nawaz Sharif will benefit. But yes, the mood has turned significantly against Musharraf.
Professor Ganguly, the beginning of the end for Pervez Musharraf?
No, I agree with Mr. Zaka. I think he's absolutely right. One must never underestimate the corporate power of the Pakistani military. And he's also correct in asserting the current chief of staff is a friend of General Musharraf's. In fact, he was handpicked by General Musharraf, and he's unlikely to surrender the extraordinary privileges of the Pakistani military. And consequently, I do not see the military going gently into that good night anytime soon. Therefore, I don't think General Musharraf's fortunes are as at low an ebb as Mr. Barton suggested. On the other hand, if the demonstrations continue and if the demonstrations become widespread and if they involve every element of Pakistani society, we have to bear in mind that the principal opposition to General Musharraf really had come from an unusual segment of Pakistani society, from the lawyers, from the judicial community, because he had systematically alienated them by dismissing a highly popular Chief Justice of the Pakistani Supreme Court. But now, if that element is joined by other elements within Pakistani society, and if they can sustain these demonstrations, and if the bulk of the anger is directed against General Musharraf, then General Musharraf will be eliminated, but what the position of the Pakistani military will still remain very secure.
All right, let me go to the phones here. A number of callers waiting to ask questions to Vijesh in Minneapolis. Hi, your question for us.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, everybody. It's a very tragic situation to actually be asking a question on the phone, but my question to both of you is based on a couple of statements made by Fazi earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Fazi, you mentioned that there's an inference that that this could be the act of jihadists. To me, that raises two questions. One is why are the jihadists threatened by the rise in popularity of Benazir Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan? And secondly, if they do indeed feel threatened by the rise of Benazir Bhutto and potentially taking power in Pakistan, isn't that an indication that President Pervez Musharraf actually allowed safe haven or an environment for these jihadist groups to flourish and proliferate in Pakistan, which is, again, adding more and more information to the angst against why did the United States choose President Pervez Musharraf as an ally in the war against terror?
Thanks very much for the question. Fazi, the role of the jihadists in this.
Well, I'd just like to answer that in three parts. Number one is when it comes to the role of the United States, the main anger in Pakistan stems from the fact that post-September 11, in order for the U.S. to protect its own democracy from the scourge of terrorism, we've had to pay for our democracy with it. And propping up a leader who was very unpopular, didn't have the financial base, Musharraf, who would have in all likelihood had to surrender to democratic forces earlier, it went into abeyance. So that's the main ire that people in Pakistan have against the U.S., is that essentially their democracy was sacrificed at the altar of the security for a United States democracy. And number two, when it comes to why would the jihadists attack Benazir Bhutto, well, you have to keep in mind is that the jihadists have been attacking a lot of symbols of state, the most powerful ones that come in terms of security. So they've been attacking the army checkposts. They've been attacking, major areas, commercial areas, anything that has symbolic value. And like most people who I've seen in Western commentators who sometimes fear that the very state is at a degree of disintegration, which I think is far-fetched, but is largely because these very important symbols tend to get attacked. Now, as far as how are they allowed to operate, you have to remember one thing in Pakistan, is Pakistan is a country which has a modern economy in parts. It has 70 million mobile phones. It's a country, despite the number of poor people, it's a country with internet, activity. It's a country with all these certain facilities that you need for communications. But at the same time, it is a totally undocumented country. 1% of the people pay income tax. Now, there are also parts of our country which are not under state control. They've got certain constitutional provisions which prevent those areas from having democracy. And they operate under a form of tribal and a masculine form of tribal democracy. And
to actually control every part of the state is impossible for the infrastructure the government has. The government itself is mired by corruption. Resources do not get to the people. There's a lot of alienation. There's poverty. People have been left out of, you know, the economic boom of the past 10 years. So if the question is that, is it a willful neglect by Musharraf which allows extremists to breed, that would be too simple an assertion, because anybody who is even hell-bent and very committed, it's a long-term process, because this is one segment of the population, albeit very small, that has been systematically alienated, and they've taken up arms. Some of it is for, you know, ideology, political Islam. Some of it is because they've been economically isolated, so they've turned to political Islam. So the question here is not so much as whether it was a willful neglect. In Pakistan, I mean, a small village is 100,000 people. In the U.S., a village might be, you know, 1,000 people, maybe 100 people. At least in the U.K., it's 100 people. So this issue of scale is significant in Pakistan. Where people go following activities is very difficult. So it's not that easy to assert this particular point. It's far more rich than it appears.
Just to let our listeners know here, some updated information. President Bush is going to comment on the assassination of Benazir Bhutto at 10 o'clock Central from Crawford, Texas. When those comments occur, we'll go to them live. Also, Neil Conan hosting an NPR News special on Bhutto's legacy as Prime Minister of Pakistan, and that is at 1 o'clock today. It takes the place of the first hour of Talk of the Nation. To the phones, to Jason in Chaska. And Jason, thanks very much for waiting. Your question.
Hi, yeah. When we're talking about people poised to take up the mantle of Benazir, there was mention of Sharif and possibly Benazir's husband. I was wondering if these sort of popular movements, if it keeps going on for a while, are there any sort of younger, more up-and-coming people who might be, maybe we haven't heard of, who might be in a position to take advantage of that and maybe pick up what Benazir left behind?
Professor Gangula, to you.
Not to my knowledge. There is a former Pakistani cricketer, Imran Khan, but he has not done particularly well in the polls. He's very telegenic and quite articulate, but on the other hand, he does not seem to have a great following. The PPP really does not have a significant bench behind Benazir Bhutto. Asif Ali Zardari, her husband, I don't think is a particularly prepossessing figure because he was known as Mr. 10% when he was in office, in that it was believed that he skimmed off 10% of every government contract, and there are a spate of corruption charges in his wake. One of the real problems in Pakistan is because of the long periods of military rule, a generation of politicians really have not been nurtured, and there is a huge vacuum as a consequence.
Fazi, one of the things that we were hearing this morning was that in a recent Pakistan poll, that Benazir Bhutto was polling ahead of other opposition leaders. Is that true? And do you think she was headed to become prime minister? What kind of a prime minister do you think she would have been?
Well, as far as polls go in Pakistan right now, it's a fairly new phenomenon. Again, we don't know how effective the sampling is. And so most people actually, polls on their own do not have much credibility in the Pakistani political circuit, because largely your voting masses also come from the rural area. Some of the polls I've seen have been, you know, done in bulk in Karachi, in our mega cities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one issue. On the issue of what kind of prime minister would have she been this time? This time round, most people did not have high hopes, because already in her previous two terms as prime minister, she had been seen to have compromised her principles largely because of corruption. And this time round, it was acknowledged that she was actively engaging with anti-democratic forces, which is, you know, the military and Pervez Musharraf. So it would have been a much tamer premiership, because it would have been under the context of a troika, which was an understanding with the army, Musharraf, and Benazir herself. So there would be far more consensus building. It would have not been as radical as, say, some people would have expected on her return or Pakistan's return to democracy.
Fazi, I know you have to go back to work and do some reporting and writing here. I really appreciate you being with us this morning. Thanks so much. Fazi Zak is a radio and television host in Pakistan, writes columns for several English language newspapers, and he was with us this morning by phone from Islamabad, Pakistan. Let me go back to the phones here for a call from Ali in Eden Prairie. Hi, Ali. Your question for Professor Ganguly.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I just had a quick question to the professor. Do you think she knew that, you know, an Islamic country, as an Islamic country, Pakistan, most of the Pakistani people did not want a woman as a prime minister, and also her close association with the United States just added to the her dangers. So with these two things combined, why did she really want to come back and do these things?
Professor, that question about her being a woman is interesting. She talked about it on CNN and said she was very aware that that was part of the anger in some parts of Pakistan about her candidacy. How big of a factor was that, do you think?
I would not exaggerate that factor because she had been successfully prime minister twice. Yes, there were pockets of Pakistan. There were groups, individuals and groups within Pakistan who were unalterably opposed to her because she was a woman. But I don't think this was a widespread, nationwide sentiment by any means. And so I would not give a great deal of credence to this.
I just want to update our listeners on the latest news coming out of Rawalpindi. Of course, if you've been listening in this morning, you know that Pakistan opposition leader Benazir Bhutto was assassinated on Thursday in a suicide attack that also killed at least 20 others at a campaign rally. Bhutto's supporters, it says here on the Associated Press, erupted in anger and grief after her death, attacking police and burning tires and election campaign posters in several cities. At the hospital where she died, some smashed glass and wailed, chanting slogans against President Pervez Musharraf. So that question to you, Professor, about what kind of a prime ministership she would have had this time around?
On this occasion, this would be a prime ministership that would be acutely dependent on the military, because she was quite frankly working hand in glove with General Musharraf. And she would have been really at the beck and call of General Musharraf for the simple reason he had basically dismissed an entire spate of charges through this ordinance known as the Reconciliation Ordinance. And this was like a sword of Damocles hanging over her head. The military was not about to surrender its privileges. And in part, we had blessed meaning the United States and particularly the Bush administration, had blessed this particular kind of arrangement. And so even if she came to power, it would be a constrained prime ministership. It would be a prime ministership that would be hobbled by the extraordinary privileges that the military has managed to accumulate over the last several decades.
And Professor, does all of that change now in the wake of what has happened to Benazir Bhutto? I mean, does that whole balance of power change? Is this the political earthquake that some analysts are saying?
Whether or not it is a political earthquake still remains to be seen. Certainly, we have felt a series of tremors. Whether these tremors can fundamentally change the political landscape remains an open question. Much depends upon the people of Pakistan and whether they seize this opportunity to finally change the balance of power within Pakistan, force the military to return to the barracks and insist that an open, free, honest and fair election be held, perhaps after the dust has settled.
And Professor, how would that be done, though? I mean, is that done by demonstrations in the streets? Is it done at the ballot box? How do they force the military
to? It cannot be done at the ballot box because the military will now try and do everything to influence the outcome at the ballot box. Already a spate of reports have emerged from Pakistan which suggest that the military were actively planning to rig the elections using every conceivable means available at their command. The only way by which I think the military can be forced to return to the barracks is through a series of sustained but peaceful demonstrations, which will require a degree of courage and organization that people will have to muster. Short of that, I'm afraid, both the United States, particularly the Bush administration, with its preference for order, will somehow bless the military and seek to have an election which is mostly an eyewash, but will not fundamentally alter the balance of power within Pakistan, and will simply postpone Pakistan's day of reckoning.
And so in the next couple, in the coming hours, in the next couple of days, you're going to be watching for the nature, the tenor of these demonstrations that will occur.
That's exactly right. And it is vitally important that these demonstrations do not resort to violence, because the moment the demonstrators resort to violence, the military will immediately say, we are putting down miscreants, we are dealing with marauders, we are dealing with people who are seeking to destabilize the country, and will resort to extraordinary force to simply crush any kind of democratic movement. So it is very important that if demonstrations take place, that these demonstrations remain peaceable at all costs.
Professor Ganguly, again, our thanks for being with us on such short notice on a day like this. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Ashumit Ganguly, Professor of Political Science, Director of Research at the Center for American and Global Security at Indiana University, and joining us this morning from Bloomington, Indiana. We also spoke with Rick Barton from the Center for Strategic and International Studies from Washington, D.C., and Fazi Zaka was with us, joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan. You can read his columns on some of the online, on some of the English language newspapers. He's also a radio and television host in Pakistan. To let you know some of the news coverage that we will be going to throughout the day, throughout the rest of the day on this news out of Pakistan, Neil Conan hosting a National Public Radio news special on Bhutto's legacy as Prime Minister of Pakistan, and that is at 1 o'clock today, and it takes the place of the first hour of Talk of the Nation, and we are standing by for comments from President Bush on Benazir Bhutto's assassination. He is in Crawford, Texas for the New Year's holiday, and we'll be making his comments from Crawford, Texas, and when he does, we will go live to them. And the 10 o'clock hour, we are talking with retiring Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Sam Hansen about a look behind the scenes of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. We'll have that conversation with Justice Hansen, but again, we will break for those comments from President Bush when they occur. Also want to tell you, in all of the news out of Pakistan this morning, there has not been a lot of political coverage of the Iowa caucuses. Mid-morning, heading to Des Moines, Iowa, next week for a collaboration with Iowa Public Radio for a town hall meeting. I think this is the first time that Minnesota Public Radio has really ever done anything like this around the Iowa caucuses. Ought to be a lot of fun. We'll be holding a town hall meeting on the eve of the Iowa caucuses and then broadcasting that the morning of the caucuses. So you'll hear that on January 3rd for the 9 a.m. hour of mid-morning. And then at 10, we'll be in Des Moines. We'll open the phone lines. We'll have talked to Iowa voters, caucus voters, about the issues that are top of mind for them. And then we're going to open the phones. We want to know what our listeners here at Minnesota Public Radio are thinking about the issues as we begin this historic voting for the presidential election. I know the election has been going on for several years now, but the voting actually begins on January 3rd. So listen for that. Lots of great coverage throughout this historic year from Minnesota Public Radio. And we're kicking it off in Des Moines on January 3rd. I hope you'll listen in for that. This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller.